already recently have done so. Establish a new VPN connection with my personal VR. I'll push out new keys ASAP. Meanwhile, audit everything. Look for Trojans, kits, or any kind of corruption. We need to be clean. Bobs nodded and rapidly vanished. In milliseconds, the moot was empty, save Garfield, myself, and a Skippy. Metadata said it was Hugh. "They'll have contingency plans," he said. I nodded. "We can only do what we can do, though." "The Moot VR source code audit is going to be a big job." Hugh cocked his head at me. "Why don't you give me a read-only copy? We've got this huge computer system." I nodded slowly. "If they found anything, I'd do the cleanup on the original." "I'll do that." "I'll set things up at my end. And why don't you drop by my place when you're ready?" Hugh said and disappeared. I glanced at Garfield, whose eyebrows were up as high as mine probably were. "He just invited you over? That was weird." I frowned. "Let's get things ready for that audit, Gar." I sent the source archive off to Hugh as soon as it was ready. Given the size of the file, I expected to have to wait anywhere from several minutes to even an hour or more for any results, but instead I received an invitation within a few mils. I popped into Hugh's VR and looked around. I was on a flat platform, seemingly floating in space. No walls, no ceiling. Overhead, rows of cylindrical satellites soared past, orbiting a distant sun. It was the kind of graphic you'd see in a science fiction movie where the scale was distorted so that things were visible that should have been too distant to be seen. Hugh gestured to a futuristic-looking easy chair, and I plopped into it, then gestured to the overhead view. "It's not intended to be realistic, of course," Hugh said, sensing the question. "Physically, we're orbiting a gray dwarf, and in only a single layer to maximize heat dissipation, but it's a good representation of Jova."
"Which is?"
"Our Matryoshka Brain project. We've currently got some 32,000 satellite modules orbiting our home star, connected in a network using SCUT channels."
"But Jova?"
"Judicious, omnicompetent, volitional, adaptive heuristic." I mimed gagging.
"You started with the name, didn't you?"
Hugh laughed. "Acronyms, the lowest form of pun." "All this, even a kick-ass name, and you still haven't achieved true AI?" "It's not about scaling, Bill. Crows and parrots were some of the more intelligent non-humans on Earth, despite having brains smaller than a walnut. Some dolphins had brain-to-body mass ratios as high as humans, but they still never displayed human-level intelligence. The biggest brain-to-body mass ratio actually belonged to a species of shrew. What matters is the organization of the brain and the wiring that connects different sub-processes. The current thinking is that we're either missing something basic or we've gone down a blind alley that we can't step back from. Jova is incredibly powerful. It can process vast quantities of information in virtually no time. Its memory space and storage is almost infinite, but it's still essentially an AMI. It still has no ability to process counterfactual thinking, experiences no WTF moments, nor does it have anything like a sense of self or any kind of internal dialogue.
I know WTF moments, but counterfactual?
Hugh grinned. Okay, let's say you've programmed an AMI to guide some wheeled vehicles from one point to another on a large flat surface. It can handle that, but now, let's say the vehicles are really on a spherical surface, like Earth, so the coordinates won't work out cleanly and the vehicle will always arrive a little off the expected destination. The AMI will never adjust its algorithms unless it's ordered to. It'll never wonder why it's always wrong. You could program the AMI to be self-correcting, and once it had figured out that spherical geometry worked better than plane geometry, it would use the new formulae. But it would never wonder why. It would never generalize from that to wonder about gravity or astronomy or anything. A real intelligence would have a WTF moment and start trying to figure out what was going on.
And you don't have that.
Not even close. We can program in each additional layer of behavior, but it never goes beyond what we've programmed. I'm
Simplifying, of course. Even in the 21st century, researchers were beyond this level, but it's the same idea. What about just simulating a brain? They did that on Earth in the 22nd century. We're proof of that. Bill, it's the difference between recording a live-action video and digitally generating a realistic animation from scratch. They were doing the former with VCRs before original Bob was born. They still hadn't managed the latter at the point when he died, at least not believably. So we can simulate an existing intelligence, but we can't create one from scratch. Exactamundo, moaned Frere. Very frustrating. I chuckled at Hugh's informality. It was possibly a little forced. He seemed to be trying to make me feel at ease. Wow. Do you still think it's even possible? We've never found any reason to believe that our own intelligence uses anything more than the physical laws of the universe. I think replication pretty much proves that. So, yes, it's a hard problem, but it's not an impossible problem. Why not just go with an enhanced replicant? Doesn't work. Well, I mean, it works, but it isn't the result we're trying for. The structure of the human brain, even a replicated one, is limited by the biological architecture that it developed on. That's why we have guppies. A backup loaded into Jova can frame Jack much higher than the rest of us, but it's still just a Bob. We've tried. In fact, our sysadmin is a Bob clone running in a virtual machine on Jova. He's a speed superintelligence, but not a quality superintelligence. Huh. I shook myself mentally. So, getting back on subject, you have the moot listing. Any idea when you'll be able to? It's done. I raised both eyebrows. Wow. Fast. That is the point. Or one of them, anyway. Now the bad news. Uh-oh. Hugh gave me a sickly grin. Yeah, they spent a lot of time preparing. They couldn't get into everything, but they really did a job on what they could access. Among other things, they managed to insert a monitor into your comms stack. My jaw dropped. Oh. So they know everything we're talking about? Nope. Anything they can do, we can do better. Right now, we're having a conversation about beer, as far as they know. Shit, we're going to be a long time untangling this. It gets worse. Our analysis says that if you attempt to physically take back the stations, they'll implement the self-destruct. I stood up. Double shit. Bob's getting ready to do just that. Garfield dropped into his lazy boy and tossed a report at me. These are the final numbers. We've got 48% of the Bobiverse online. Of the other 52%, 18% are Starfleet. That many? They've been replicating aggressively, Bill. I think they've been planning this for a while now. So anyway, just over a third of the Bobiverse is offline, hard. We're still getting some new connections as people figure out how to use the SCUT transceivers on drones and other local equipment, but that's only good for basic communications. Meanwhile, this, I waved a sheet that I'd been holding. I was checking your list of outages. They're all units that I updated a few days ago because they still had the original keys. Someone recorded my session, saved the new keys, then used them to corrupt those stations. I gritted my teeth. I fell for a classic piece of social engineering. Got scared into doing exactly what they wanted, and they were ready for it. Wow. That's very sophisticated. Almost more than I'm willing to accept from these guys. They seem more like a bunch of goofs than manipulative geniuses. Well, reality trumps expectations, I guess. Also, I picked up another sheet, the Starfleet ultimatum. I think Lenny was intending to deliver this at the moot, but I cut him off before he could get to it. I held up the page and made a show of examining it, although I already knew the contents. They offer to restore all communications and functionality as long as we agree to stop interfering with indigenous species. So, blackmail. Mm-hmm. Any takers so far? I snorted. They badly misjudged the Bobiverse, Gar. I think whoever was the common ancestor of Starfleet had already drifted away from Bobhood and didn't realize it. He thought we'd behave like he would have. Fail. Weird, though, that they were good enough to social engineer you, but not good enough to foresee the general reaction. I ignored Garfield's return to that theme. What about physical location? Is Starfleet located anywhere in particular? Generally speaking, they're up toward the Perseus Transit, but if you mean are they all conveniently clumped together, no. Are you seriously thinking about physical combat? I'm not putting anything beyond discussion at this point. As I said in the moot, these guys aren't Bobs. They don't think like Bobs, they don't act like Bobs. Garfield sighed heavily. Wonderful. 31. Strategies. Bob, July 2334, outskirts Eta Leporis. We sat around my VR library, drinks in hand, all contemplating the future. Garfield, Hugh, Bill, and Bridget were represented in video windows rather than actually being here. Fairly low res, too. Not quite Minecraft, but certainly below movie-level quality. My temporary relay station was just about maxed out with this meeting. Bridget was staring into space, silently nursing her drink, and no one had been willing to break into her private contemplation. Abruptly, she sat forward.
I admit I'm getting into metaphysical speculation here, but what if there was only one me around? What if I was taken offline, backed up, and the backup was restored there, and later the process was reversed, and the backup from here was loaded into my original matrix?
Hugh stared at Bridget in apparent surprise.
Closest continuer. The idea being that there will only ever be one Bridget, so you have continuity.
In the same way that Star Trek characters had it when they got transported around, Garfield replied.
You guys have really got to let go of Star Trek,
Bridget commented.
Although in this case it is sort of relevant. They were disassembled, right?
I waggled a hand so-so. There were some attempts to soften it, like that Barclay episode where he found the crew trapped in the matter stream. But then the Thomas Riker episode simply created a new Riker, Garfield replied. Obviously that's incompatible with the concept of a unique soul. Bridget made a face and sat back, shaking her head as we gathered steam. Hugh said,
Unless the process duplicates the soul as well.
It's just quantum states, Garfield interjected.
But where does the soul of a newborn come from? I asked.
They can be created, assuming they exist, so—
My God!
Bridget exclaimed. All conversation cut off.
I'm sorry I brought it up.
She crossed her arms and looked away, body language projecting anger. An awkward silence reigned for a millisecond or two before Garfield muttered, It's still just quantum states.
Yes, but you could have—
I chopped off my comment as Bridget's glare threatened to peel paint off my hull in real. Okay, fine. Can we move on then? No one said anything, so I continued. We have a foursome again, at least in principle, until comms are all back up. All you guys can do is monitor, but it should help a bit. I've been observing several locations using roamers and forwarding the recordings to Hugh for analysis. A little real-time eyeballing might catch something sooner.
I'm going to be a little busy with the comms thing, Bill said.
Will is going to cover for me. He'll keep me up to date if I miss a session.
Hugh grimaced.
I've already mentioned that I'd be willing to take that on.
It's okay, Hugh. Will is the official backup, Bob, and he has the time, but you're welcome to the sessions as well, of course. After all, you are part of the team.
Bill nodded to Hugh, then popped out.
Hugh leaned forward and put his elbows on his knees. He appeared momentarily frustrated before his expression smoothed out.
On the surveillance front, there is some indication of an organization in Three Lagoons. Nothing obvious. It's not like people are openly talking about blowing things up, but similar patterns of conversation about similar subjects using similar circumlocutions says something is going on, and something that people want to keep quiet. I've tagged the speakers, and facial recognition routines will alert us any time they come into camera range.
Any idea how many organizations are involved?
Bridget said. She'd seemed to have gone back into her shell, and her abrupt comment took us by surprise. Even Hugh hesitated, mentally regrouping.
Very probably more than one. There are two distinct patterns of dialogue. My money's on two, although there could be three or even four.
Agreed,
Bridget replied.
We can at least come up with motivations for two potential groups, the administrator and the resistance.
Hugh nodded, his eyebrows going up.
Good analysis, and I agree. So do we continue to observe, or do we rattle the bushes to see what we flush out?
We still don't have any indication of Bender's location, I replied. If we go all in here, we could lose any chance of finding him.
Or greatly improve it,
Bridget said.
Look, if the group or groups have global communications, then we can at least potentially find out if he's anywhere on Heaven's River. If they don't, then blowing it here won't screw us in other towns.
And a sequential search of a billion miles of megastructure is still a non-starter, Garfield added. Especially now that you're on your own, Bob. At least physically. I don't see how you can realistically continue the expedition the same way.
I'm probably going to have to clone. I can make that decision when the new matrices are complete.
Meanwhile, you are on your own, Garfield shook his head. I don't see you getting a lot done while waiting for the matrices. At least some bush rattling might give you something new to work on.
Okay, I concede.
Vote. It appeared I would be rattling some bushes. 32. Losing on purpose. Bob, July 2334, Three Lagoons. Bushes. Rattling of process 4. I had to admit, it wasn't really in my wheelhouse. We did have one simple tactic based on previous experience, go out in public together, but without a full midpoint station, that was out. Or was it? We only had to go out long enough to make the association. The AMI controllers could handle an instruction like, follow Bob. If there was a wood cutting of our images out there, it should trigger something. I sat in our surprisingly spacious hotel room, silently exchanging looks with the other three Mannies. The AMIs weren't geniuses, but they could handle simple directives as long as they didn't have to talk. The others were dialed into their Mannies well enough to be able to give them verbal commands and receive basic audiovisual input. Good enough for the current operation, but as an ongoing thing, it would be completely unworkable. I was certain I could feel the crew metaphorically standing over my shoulder ready to kibitz. Nonsense, of course, but a hard feeling to shake. Finally, I got to my feet. Wow, what a talkative bunch. Let's get this done, shall we?
Brains, said Garfield's Manny.
Taking their cue from me, the Mannies stood. I opened the door and we trooped out, heads down, like a chain gang being led off to a day of hard labor. Bridget had suggested we should proceed toward the local library, pointing out quite reasonably that our pursuers would probably have staked it out, given our prior behavior. It wasn't a bad strategy, but I couldn't shake a certain lamb-to-the-slaughter vibe. As it turned out, I needn't have bothered my butt over it. Halfway to the library, Will said over the intercom, "You're being followed."
"Well, good," Bridget replied. "Maybe we can get somewhere with this mess."
She paused.
"I see them. Two males, about 20 yards back."
No, Garfield said, bemused. "A male and female paralleling us on the left." I barely managed to avoid rolling my eyes. "Outstanding. I'll give you this, Bridget. Your plans work." She didn't reply, but I imagined a slightest trace of a smile. "They're not together," Will said. "There's no coordination between them. Not bracketing you, not trying to keep the spacing even. If anything, I'd say one group is following the other group." "Maybe we can use that when the time comes. For now, though, let's just continue on, oblivious." I demonstrated by slowing down to check out some of the wares in storefront displays. I was probably being a little obvious, but then maybe I wasn't being objective. I was getting that itchy feeling between the shoulder blades. I kept telling myself they didn't all have guns, but it wasn't as reassuring as I'd hoped.
Even a thrown blade would certainly do some damage.
Despite myself, I started rolling my eyes around to check in every direction. I quickly spotted the two groups of stalkers. Now came the risky part. While I was okay with getting nabbed, I couldn't take a chance on three unmanned Mannies being taken, with the inevitable questions it would raise. Fortunately, we'd scripted this. I turned and huddled with the Mannies. After a few seconds, the other three started back the way we'd come, at a deliberately casual pace. I, meanwhile, continued on, trying to project urgency from every follicle.
One group seemed like they were considering following the other Mannies, but then decided you were an easier target, Bridget said. Both groups are now on your tail.
I soon reached the library, and sure enough, the plaza was almost completely clear of people. I wondered how the Quinlans managed to do that without creating a spectacle. On Earth, if someone had tried getting people to leave an area, they'd end up with an audience twice the size. Here, people seemed to understand the concept of go away. And I said almost, right? A couple of groups of Quinlans around the periphery were making a laughable attempt to appear casual, just standing around, not talking, while fingering something hidden by their backpacks. My mind immediately conjured up Gollum, wondering what they had in their pockets. I stopped dead, swiveling only my very mobile Quinlan eyeballs, and that was the cue for the party to start. The two groups of Quinlans that had been waiting turned and made for me, pulling out the usual pig stickers. Before they could get 10 feet, one of our two groups of stalkers pulled out trank pistols and started shooting. So much for no guns. The other stalker group immediately made for them, pig stickers in hand. The gun-toting Quinlans appeared to be getting the upper hand when yet another group ran into the plaza and jumped them. I stood in the center of the maelstrom, seemingly totally forgotten.
"It's nice to be popular, isn't it?" Garfield observed.
"But maybe not conducive to a long life," I replied. "I'm having second thoughts. I vote for bugging out."
"Yep." "Agreed."
"Move it."
Well, there was a consensus anyway, reinforced by my already receding butt. I dropped to all fours and prepared to put on some speed. Immediately, the feuding groups found their own consensus, which seemed to consist of not letting me get away. Abandoning their battle, the still-standing combatants turned as one and made after me.
"They have guns," I said. "Some of them," Bridget replied.
"Definitely tranquilizer pistols," Hugh said.
"You're sure because..."
"Victims didn't drop like they would from shock. It's more of an ouch-stagger-fall thing."
Bridget gave that a moment's thought.
"Okay, if you get shot by one of those things, you should act appropriately."
"What, you still want me to get captured?" I didn't try to disguise the surprise in my voice. The others were silent for a moment as I navigated a quick turn around a fountain.
"Jerry's out at this point," Bridget replied. "But we might find ourselves..."
"Oof!" I grunted as I was hit by a most professional-feeling tackle. The defender had come around the other side of the fountain and taken me by surprise. When the rolling stopped, I found myself looking up at a Quinlan. He seemed as surprised as me. We stared at each other for a second while I tried to decide if I wanted to be captured. Then the decision was taken away from me as some large number of Quinlan bodies piled on. I honestly doubt that I could have heaved them off, even going full Manny. They slapped manacles on me. Quinlan manacles were interesting. They attached to all four limbs, and they included a device in the center that would open like a parachute if I dove into the water and tried to swim away. Quite ingenious. I spent several seconds inspecting it. Probably too intently. The group leader waved a pig sticker in my face and said something in a sharp voice. I realized that I hadn't been paying attention, a consequence of not actually being in personal danger. I guess. I'd have to do better. I couldn't afford to have them take the Manny apart, and I didn't want them to get the idea I wasn't a flesh-and-blood Quinlan. I rewound and played back her comment in frame jack.
"I'm not seeing any of the Super Quinlan stuff our upriver correspondents reported. I guess maybe they're just incompetent."
Her crew laughed at her comment, then went quiet as she raised a hand. This one was tough, and they knew it. I resolved to act properly intimidated as she leaned in close.
You give us any trouble, Moochin, and I'll carve your flaps off.
That was a real threat. A Quinlan with their arm flaps missing would never be able to swim properly again. It would be kind of like the medieval practice of cutting off a hand. I wasn't sure if it was a realistic threat or just bravado, but I wasn't going to push it. After all, technically, this is what I'd wanted. What we'd wanted. Okay, what Bridget had wanted. The crew was busy at the moment, chivvying their manis back into the river. It hadn't taken us long to realize that the losers would be going for the rest of our group, just to have something to show their bosses. My captors grabbed me under my arms and started hustling me along. I looked around but couldn't spot any of the other groups of pursuers. I received a slap on the back of the head from one of the crew, a wizened character that for some reason reminded me of Popeye.
"Keep your head down," he growled.
I almost decked him, but reminded myself yet again that this was according to plan. "Can you identify which group caught you?" That was Garfield. "Yeah," I replied, "the sword critter group."
"We think our manis are being stalked by the pistol critters now," Bridget reported.
"I've got one of the small roamers," Garfield said. "I'm trying to keep Bob's group in sight. It would have been nice if we could have been stocked with drones, you know." "No room," I replied. "I thought about it, believe me." I received another slap on the head from Popeye for no reason that I could see. I decided that in the fullness of time, I'd be returning the attention with interest. In short order, we entered a nondescript building, two flights up, and we were in a surprisingly spacious apartment. "I like what you've done with the pl—" I was driven back a step as Popeye planted the butt of his sword into my midsection. Based on Quinlan anatomy, it should have had exactly the same effect on a Quinlan as it would on a human. Or a Delton, or a Pav. Interesting. I shelved that thought for the wee small hours and turned to Popeye. I hadn't folded in the expected manner, and there definitely hadn't been an oof. It wasn't lost on him, as his face was showing a bit of the Quinlan equivalent of widening eyes. I glared at him. "Do that again and all the spinach in the world won't protect you." His fear was replaced with bemusement. I doubt that spinach had translated well, but he certainly understood the threat. He raised his pig sticker to give me another whack, and the boss lady said his name sharply. I instructed the translator to associate it with Popeye in the future. Popeye lowered the sword but gave me an evil grin.
"Any time, Moochin."
Boss lady pointed me at a chair. As I sat, one of the crew unlatched my leg and ran the manacle through a gap in the furniture, then re-manacled me. It seemed amateurish. Even at Quinlan's strength, I could probably smash the chair and free myself, but maybe the point was to just slow me down. The manacles themselves appeared to be some form of dense wood, metal being at a premium in Heaven's River, connected by a tightly braided rope. I estimated that I could just about break them if I needed to. I turned away from my captors and opened my mouth. A couple of flea-sized roamers popped out and started climbing down my fur, with orders to strategically weaken my bindings, just in case. Boss lady came over, pulled a chair around, and sat in front of me. I quickly ordered my fleas to continue their journey under my fur. While it was unlikely that she'd try to groom me, I couldn't afford to have her get a close look at my passengers.
"So, what do we call you?"
Well, that was a good deal more friendly than I'd expected. "Bob. And you?"
"You can call me Frida."
The translation software automatically assigned a random human equivalent to whatever she actually said.
"So now, Bob, why don't you tell me about you and your friends?"
I had a pretty good idea how this was going to play out, but I decided I might as well follow the script. "My friends and I have all recently reached adulthood, and we decided to embark on a sabbatical to explore the river before settling down. It's pretty common, at least where we come from." Frida stared at me for a moment in silence, then sighed.
"Okay, Bob, I guess we have to go through the standard lies first. We initially thought you might have been spies for the administrator, but you seemed interested in the oddest things. And you followed Skeev, but not to do him harm, as it turned out. I admit to being perplexed. Are you another resistance group?
Logically, to answer that, I'd have to know what resistance group you are, but short answer, we aren't part of any resistance group, nor are we part of the administrator's group. We actually don't know anything more about the administrator than most people.
So, what are you?
Like I said, travelers.
Frida glanced over top of my head and nodded. Immediately, I felt a blinding pain. I arched my back reflexively as internal systems went into damage control. I turned my head to see Popeye standing there with a couple of wires in his hands, insulation stripped off at the ends. My gaze followed the wires back until they terminated in what were almost certainly some batteries wired up in series. Well, that explained it. Manny's wouldn't be any more resistant to electricity than any bio. That was a real problem, and I added an item to my to-do to look into countermeasures.
Hurts, doesn't it?
Popeye grinned at me.
Why don't you threaten me again, Mochin?
Okay, next time you use that on me, I'm going to throw you through the nearest wall. Happy?
Let's try to stay on topic, shall we?
Frida said, interrupting the stare-off.
Bab, sooner or later you'll give us what we want. Why not spare yourself some pain? We're not really your enemy.
I turned back to her. Maybe simple candor would work. Look, Frida, cards on the table. We're looking for a friend. I mean it.
We're not associated with the administrator or any underlords or lords of Flatbush or any resistance to or against any of the above.
Paper on the table? Lords of Flatbushes?
Frida frowned at me, then with a weary sigh, she nodded over my head.
No, do not again, searing pain, but this time I had the sensory feedback filters dialed up, so it registered more as data than as agony.
Then Popeye snickered.
Want to threaten me some more?
That did it. The fleas had made a good start on my wrist manacles while we'd been talking. Time to test the results. I stood up, and before anyone could even begin to react, I yanked upward. The manacles snapped exactly as I hoped they would, although my telltales registered some blunt force damage around my wrists. I reached, grabbed a handful of Popeye's fur, and flung him at the nearest wall. He didn't quite go through it, which I suppose qualified as false advertising on my part, but he definitely damaged the drywall. His unconscious form slid slowly to the floor, leaving a more or less Popeye-shaped indentation a couple of feet above the baseboards. I turned back to Frida to make some snappy comment and found myself staring at the pointy end of several pig stickers. The sword wielders all had a kind of wide-eyed, semi-panicked look that very clearly stated that they would react badly to, just about anything. I cocked my head and said, "Well, I did warn him." It took a few minutes, but I finally convinced them that I wasn't about to go on a killing spree or make a run for it. We were once again seated, although Frida's chair was placed a couple of feet farther away than before. I glanced at the wires, which were still lying on the floor where Popeye had dropped them. No one had volunteered to man his station. Popeye had been helped to another room where, presumably, he was receiving some medical attention. "I'm a little surprised," I said, gesturing to the wires. "I thought that level of technology was banned." Frida tried to smile and did a credible job, honestly.
"We don't tend to be law-abiding as a rule."
"We being the resistance?" She frowned at me.
"You really don't know. And yet you recognize the battery as forbidden tech."
I frowned back at her. "Look, why don't you think of me as someone who has just discovered this whole administrator resistance conspiracy thing and is still trying to figure it out? It's actually true."
"I'd say there's a lot more to you than that. For starters, There are your physical abilities. There's a report that one of you took a dart point blank and just got mad. Then there are the weird phrases and slang you keep spouting.
She stared at me, thinking, then added,
You are definitely odd. Something new. I think we're going to need to get the higher-ups involved.
I nodded in what I hoped was a respectful manner. Inside, I was doing a happy dance. This might finally be a break. If these people were amenable to a little give and take, I could conceivably get some real information on Bender. Finally. They put me in a back room with a small high window, far too small to fit through. A lot of bumping and banging on the other side of the door made me think they were reinforcing the lock, probably with furniture. I had a feeling that this apartment had been specifically picked for its security features. Or maybe built. Could the entire building be a resistance stronghold? I'd have loved to check it out, but unfortunately most of my biggest roamers were ensconced in various pubs, listening for information about the resistance, and I didn't want to risk the rest. The whole spying thing seemed like an obsolete strategy, but I didn't want the roamers to have to cross some unknown stretch of city to get back to me. I'd hold that plan in reserve for now. Meanwhile, I figured now might be a good time to check in. I didn't want to interrupt anything important, so I settled for a ping to my friends just to let them know I was available. Hey, Bob, Garfield replied. How's tricks?
You okay?
Bridget said. Hey, Will said. I'm okay, I replied to everyone. I've been captured by the Resistance. They don't seem to have a name beyond that. I guess there's the Resistance and the Administrator that they are resisting, not a lot of requirement for labels.
Humans would have come up with an acronym, Garfield said with a chuckle.
And it would have been terrible,
Bridget added.
I'm afraid I lost you, Bob, Garfield said. I had to dodge some search parties. I doubt they know about roamers, and I don't want to change that. I had a thought. Listen, Gar, can you call in all the surveillance roamers? Their mission's been rendered redundant at this point, and I'd like to get us all up to full strength.
No problem, Bob. But I'll have to find you after I collect them.
I nodded, even though no one could see that.
We'll deal with that when we have to. For now, let's make sure we keep each other updated. As soon as we have some useful info, we'll reevaluate.
The sun was going down, or however you phrased it, in Heaven's River, and I could hear the silence descending over Three Lagoons as people turned in for the night. I put my ear to the door to try to determine what my hosts might be up to. A couple of voices were engaged in desultory conversation. It seemed the night shift was on duty. Not that it mattered. I had no intention of escaping at this point unless I decided my Manny was in real danger. But of more immediate value, I could look forward to being undisturbed for a while. I laid down on the single bed and left the Manny on standby. I materialized in my VR and sighed with contentment as I relaxed into my Lazy Boy recliner. The others had successfully maneuvered their Mannies into the water, where they were now once again anchored at the bottom, well below maximum Quinlan diving depth. Garfield was getting all the roamers back to the hotel room. Hugh was trying to chivvy some surveillance drones closer to our location so they could follow my movement. Unfortunately, too much activity tended to burn out the drone's heat sinks, so every vector had to be carefully planned. There was an email from Bill reporting on progress against Starfleet. Apparently things were heating up. I read with growing alarm as I realized how much of the Bobiverse was inaccessible.
Guppy, you rang?
Change the keys on our auto factories, then do a full software audit. I want to be absolutely sure they aren't compromised.
By your command.
I smiled as Guppy signed off. His snark had increased over the years. I still hadn't decided if it was genuine self-awareness or if he was just adapting to my command style. I didn't really want to do a deep check, lest I be disappointed by the result. I had an advantage in that I built and set up the auto factories in Eta Leporis while I had only a low bandwidth connection to the Bobiverse in general. Most other Bobs wouldn't have the same protection. Bill hadn't given specifics about who might be compromised. I went back to the email from Bill and continued reading. It took only a few mils to come to the part about booby traps in the comms stations.
Great. Well, it wouldn't hurt to get all my equipment close to the big station, and I could decide what to do at that point. Maybe Bill and company would have figured out a workaround by then.
33. Ultimatums. Bill, July 2334, Vert. I moped around my VR, walking the gravel paths and parking my butt on convenient benches whenever the mood struck. Being punted from the expedition was hitting harder than it should. The Heavens River expedition was the most fun I'd had in a long time, and I already missed it. I was interrupted in my pity party by a ping from Garfield. He popped in the moment I acknowledged. Auto factories are going down everywhere, he said without preamble. What? It looks like Starfleet is upping their game. They'd apparently also hacked most of the auto factory hardware at some point as part of their preparations. They've sent an invitation to meet. To you? Well, you black-holed them. Okay, point taken. I took a look at the invitation, then unblocked Lenny and replied. Lenny had brought backup this time. A half dozen Starfleet members, all dressed in the identical, not quite TNG, red uniforms, stood behind him. It was strictly psychological, of course. There was no possibility of any form of physical coercion in the moot VR. But the smug looks on all their faces weren't helping this situation. All right, Lenny, make it quick, I said, glaring at him. I don't think you're in a position to be ordering people around, he replied with a smirk. And you're not in a position to piss me off more than you already have, I replied. Nothing you've done is irreparable. We can build more auto factories. We can just nuke the current stations if we can't get them back and build new ones. For that matter, the humans might just do that regardless. Well, assuming we let you just go ahead and do that. What's that supposed to mean? I glared at him. The auto factories we control are going to be building busters, vessels, and matrices. What makes you think we'll just let you take them back? I stared at him silent for entire milliseconds. You're declaring war. Now, Bill, let's not get ahead of ourselves. We're establishing ourselves as a presence you have to deal with. You don't own the universe, you know. As Bob says, it's a free galaxy. And you're starting off by stealing someone else's stuff and delivering ultimatums. Not a great way to establish your moral credibility. It's not that simple. Yeah, Lenny, it is. And apparently you and your friends have drifted so far that you don't understand that anymore. You can call it anything you want, but it's still a declaration of war. Finally, Lenny lost the smirk. Maybe he was starting to realize that things weren't going to go according to script. Bill, we're not going to go around shooting at other Bobs. All we want is for the Bobiverse to stop interfering with biologicals. I sighed and gave him my best tired look. And you intend to enforce your decision with theft and threats. Sorry, Lenny, that's a big old fail. You don't get to make that decision, Bill. The Bobs... Wait. You're saying I don't have the right to make a unilateral decision for everyone else, but you do? Interesting. Any Bob that doesn't want to be involved doesn't have to be, Lenny, but I have a funny feeling there will be no shortage of support. Original Bob wouldn't have sat still for this, and most of us are still close enough to him. Now it was Lenny's turn to give me a tired look.
Then I guess it's going to come down to who can replicate faster.
Looks like it, I replied.
Bye, Lenny.
And I closed their connections. The moot hall seemed to be constantly busy lately. At the moment, Bobs milled around in different groups, updating whiteboards or holotanks or whatever metaphor worked best for them. We had teams working on cataloging the Starfleet-controlled systems and other teams working on strategies to take them back. Task forces worked on defensive plans while others worked on taking the fight to them. This last bit was more problematic, as it appeared that Starfleet had removed as much public information about themselves as they'd been able. Large swaths of the Starfleet genealogy were simply gone from the databases, as was location information. This wasn't a spur-of-the-moment decision on their part, and I was beginning to wonder if it was actually about the Prime Directive. This coup, for that was all it could be, was too well-planned and too widespread. On the other hand, when original Bob got a bee up his butt about something, he could be incredibly obsessive. I had to remember that. Despite replicative drift, these people were still Bob-based. Thor came up to me. "We've recovered two relay stations." "How?" "Physical inspection and reset." "I thought Starfleet gimmicked them to blow up if touched." "They did. And we've lost six stations that way, but Marcus found a workaround. Or one of his engineering friends on Poseidon did. We think we can get most of them back, but we have to figure out how to get the data to other Bobs without Starfleet getting hold of it and rigging a countermeasure." I closed my eyes and hung my head. It really was war, complete with espionage and counterintelligence. "Okay, Thor, thanks. We can send it directly to any Bobs we know have clean systems. For the rest, give it to the Skippies as intermediaries. No one is going to get anything from them without their permission." 10-4. Thor nodded and stalked off. At some point, I was pretty sure someone was going to get busterized. It didn't matter which side, in the end. War had come to the Bobiverse. 34. Higher-ups. Bob, July 2334, Three Lagoons. My Manny's AMI alerted me to a non-routine condition, and I quickly entered the android. A lot of banging and dragging seemed to indicate that my captors were unbarricading the door to my room. I waited patiently and was finally rewarded with a view of the pointy end of several short swords. "Greetings. Why, yes, I will have the pie," I said with a smile. No one appeared to have had enough coffee because there was a distinct lack of humor in their responses. One of them blinked a few times and Frida waved, "Get up," with her sword. As I exited my room, I came face to face with Popeye. He glared at me but was as silent as the rest. I didn't see any casts or cartoon X-shaped band-aids anywhere, so I guess I hadn't hurt him too badly. Probably just a few bruises and a fractured ego. There was a surprise waiting for me, a new, much heftier set of manacles of the metal variety. And a cop, or at least someone dressed as a cop. It occurred to me that if we were going for a walk, there would have to be an explanation for one of us being in chains. Finally, Frida broke the silence.
"If you step out of line, we'll kill you, and to hell with any information you might have."
"Got it. No making trouble." I tried to smile reassuringly. Frida gave me a stony expression in response, and Popeye's scowl grew even more intense. The other two goons and the ersatz cop didn't react at all. Outside, I was surprised to find a wagon waiting for us. A good choice. It gave them something to chain me to. The driver never even turned around as we loaded up. "So, is this..."
"Shut up."
Well, that was pretty clear. There would be no debriefing during the trip. I hoped it was a short drive. The driver seemed to be making a point of avoiding the busier roads. I tried to see that as significant, but had to admit it was basic common sense. We left the dock area in short order and soon were winding through avenues with more and more vegetation and less construction. This looked like the right side of the tracks, and I found myself perplexed that the resistance would be headquartered in the ritzy area of town. We pulled up in front of a surprisingly well-appointed private home, even considering the area. Someone had money, that was certain. Whether it was their own money or part of the resistance was another question. We reversed the loading sequence with the same facial expressions from all concerned and the same waving of pig stickers. The cop left with the wagon driver, which led me to believe he might be a real cop. Frida appeared to be relaxing a little, though. Maybe my complete lack of troublemaking during the trip helped. She waved a hand at the house.
We are told we'll be able to talk to a higher-up here.
I'm looking forward to it. She gave me an arch look.
Understand, Bob. You may not come out of here alive if we don't like your answers.
I may not have the answers you want, Frida. You really need to get over the idea that I'm some kind of player in whatever politics you've got going on here.
If you can convince them, you might just see the sunset.
She ushered me through the front door under the disdainful gaze of the Quinlan version of Jeeves. He gestured for us to follow him and brought us to a back room with floor-to-ceiling books. A library! I exclaimed, and Frida turned a quizzical eye on me.
You and your friends certainly have a thing for books. I'm hoping I can find out why today.
You'll be staying?
Hope so. We're a little tired of being kept in the dark.
She gestured to a seat, and I sat. Once again, I was chained to the furniture. Hopefully the goons wouldn't notice that my fleas had once again wreaked havoc on the integrity of my bonds. A door opened at the other end of the library, and a Quinlan walked in. This was the homeowner, to judge from the coiffing and decorations. She gave me the up-and-down glance, plainly relegating me to the status of pond scum, then made an imperious gesture to someone behind her. Two Quinlans came forward, carrying what looked for all the world like one of those antique Motorola radios, a table model with a wooden case and big knobs. This was getting curiouser and curiouser. For a species that supposedly didn't have anything beyond the steam era, they sure seemed to have a lot of tech. It would seem the administrator didn't have as much of an iron grip as they thought. They placed the radio in front of me, and one of the attendants started fiddling with dials. In seconds, a Quinlan voice sounded from the speaker.
Ready here.
Frida stepped forward, looking weirdly nervous.
Madame Cohoina, we have the unknown agent here, captured at great risk to ourselves. As discussed, we want—
The Empress flicked a hand, barely a movement, but Frida was silenced.
You will be paid well for your risks and pain,
she said, glancing at Popeye.
However, our organization continues to exist only because we pay attention to need to know.
The Empress nodded toward Jeeves.
My man will take care of payment and can provide nourishment if you are fatigued from your travels.
When she ended her mini speech, it was obvious she was done. Some kind of body language, perhaps, that said, "You're dismissed." Frida frowned and opened her mouth, but one of her group put a hand on her arm. Thinking better of it, Frida gave a nod, well short of a bow and probably a calculated slight from the slight widening of nostrils and narrowing of eyes on the Empress's face, and the group turned and followed Jeeves out of the room. The Empress gave me another up-and-down scan, followed by a silent, down-the-nose look. It probably would have put most people in their place, but she was playing against a computer running an Android. No body language except what I chose to display, and at the moment I was playing poker. Evidently, she realized a standoff was not to her advantage. She addressed the Motorola.
This is one of the four persons who have led us on such an interesting chase through several cities. This one in particular picked up one of our agents with one hand and threw him against a wall.
Thank you, Natasha, the Motorola said.
I had to stifle a chuckle. The translator program randomly assigned human names whenever a new native name was used, and the other way around. But occasionally the choice was bang on. She looked like a Natasha.
What shall I call you? Said Motorola.
I'm Bob, I replied.
Hello, Bob. I'm Motorola.
Again, I had to suppress a snicker. I could, as I had in this case, override the default selections. Of course, the locals would only hear the local Quinlan versions of names. Okay, and this is standard practice for visitors to your city?
Let's not dance around, all right? I've read all the witness accounts and transcripts.
You and your friends have some kind of knowledge or tech that gives you an edge. We were sure you were crew, and we were going to take you down, but you kept getting away. Now, I'm not so sure.
The way it had said crew meant something. By crew, you mean Quinlans who work for the administrator?
That's right. It's interesting. You either have even less knowledge of the way things are than the average Quinlan, or you are very, very good with the cover story. Which is it?
It's the former. Honestly, I considered the possibility that your group was with the administrator, but that's seeming less likely. I gestured toward the radio. This, in particular, doesn't look like something the boss of Heaven's River would have to settle for. I have to assume the guys with guns were administrator crew because you all didn't seem to be getting along. After a moment of silence, Motorola said,
"Interesting that you know about the level of technology displayed by this device, and about guns. Even most of the resistance haven't ever seen one."
"Oops.
We have a fascinating problem here, Bob,"
it continued.
"My compatriots want to just skip the talking and peel you with a knife until we get something we can use. On the other hand, that didn't turn out well for Popeye, based on Frida's report. It's been suggested that we just kill you and remove the risk. What can you offer me as an alternative?"
I spared a moment to be amused. Motorola was being very civil, but the subtext was that it wanted information, or something, and was trying to figure out the most effective way to get it. For now, a polite discussion. Later, possibly, pain and screaming and blood. And possibly a thermite detonation. I bet that would mess up Natasha's hardwood floors. Well, I wasn't really averse to some form of cooperation. I just had to figure out what they needed, what they wanted, and what a good exchange rate would be. "Look, Motorola, I don't understand the politics well enough to know what's going on or what you might consider of value, either as information or goods. I mean, I have money, but I'm sure one of Natasha's place settings is worth more than what's in my pockets." A snort drifted over from the chaise on which Natasha was sitting.
"We've already examined the contents of your backpack," Motorola replied. "There's nothing in there we are interested in. Although I think the long knife is from one of our agents, and on that subject, you and your group appear to be elite athletes, based on the descriptions of your escapes."
No doubt highly exaggerated. And you have to take into account the fact that we were being chased by persons unknown waving sharp objects, fear lens wings, and all that.
"Wings?"
I thought for a moment. The translation routine had converted the partial aphorism literally, and while Quinlans knew about wings, there being a local equivalent to birds, their aphorisms generally involved swimming. It appeared the incomplete translation job at the beginning of the expedition was going to come back to bite me. It wasn't a big deal in the grand scheme of things, but it was another reason for Motorola to wonder about me. I decided that trying to excuse or explain it would just dig me in deeper. Better to move on. "Look, maybe if you could tell me what your angle is, I could come up with something that would be of value to you." Natasha shifted in her chair and turned her head toward me. She'd stayed out of the conversation until now, but apparently I'd crossed some kind of line.
"You seem to have forgotten who is interrogating whom. In this scenario, we ask, you answer."
"So ask," I said. "So far, that hasn't gotten you anywhere, though. I'd like to be cooperative, but I don't know what you're looking for."
"We want to know who you work for, where your loyalties lie, what your goals are, and what assets you have or have access to. Is that clear enough?"
I glanced over at Motorola, who hadn't uttered a peep during this exchange. "Okay, I don't work for anyone. My loyalty is to my friends. My goal is to find one of my friends, and my assets are all in my backpack." Natasha eyed me silently for several seconds, then picked up a small bell and jingled it. Jeeves stepped into the room, and she said to him,
"Bring in Philip."
Jeeves bowed and left. Natasha turned to me.
"Philip is an expert with sharp objects and their uses. A few minutes of his attentions and your memory should improve."
"Natasha, this is not—"
"Enough, Motorola. You're taking too long, and your particular expertise doesn't appear to have any bearing on the specifics of the situation. I think we'll try my way. Perhaps later our friend will listen more carefully to your questions."
There was no response from the radio. I surreptitiously twisted on my manacles and felt a satisfying looseness to them. In short order, a Quinlan came in carrying something wrapped in a leather skin. He sat down and unrolled it on the coffee table beside my backpack, then smiled at me, doubtless looking for a reaction. It was the weirdest collection of knives and assorted implements I'd ever seen. Straight ones, curved ones, twisted ones. Some of those items had to be there just for show. There couldn't possibly be an actual function for that one, for instance. I smiled innocently back at him. "My kitchen's mostly pretty well stocked, but I wouldn't mind the long twisty one. How much for that?" Philip's smile faltered, and he half glanced over at Natasha before aborting the action. He picked up the implement in question and held it up, still determined to continue the performance.
"This is for removing arm webbing. Would you like me to demonstrate?"
I stared him straight in the eye. "Philip, the moment I think I'm in any real danger, this whole room with everyone in it will be reduced to toothpicks. It's an insurance policy, a dead man's switch. We're kind of careful that way." There was a silence in the room for several seconds, then Motorola said, "And we don't like explodey stuff." I stared at the radio, totally boggled. The translation routine had handled that perfectly, including the idiom. Wait a minute. That hadn't been translated. That was rendered in English, but how would a Quinlan or any denizens of Heaven's River know English unless... Bender? There was a pause. Bob? Part 2. Perverse Instantiations. 1. Escape. Bob, July 2334, Three Lagoons. I stared, stunned, at the radio. What the hell? You can't be more surprised than me, Bob. Last time I saw you, you didn't have fur. Last time I saw you, you weren't commanding an armed resistance group of otters.
What is this?
Natasha snarled.
What language are you speaking? Speak, Quinlan, or this meeting is over.
I gave the radio an okay hand gesture, which didn't particularly mean anything to a Quinlan, but would to Bender. It occurred to me that I didn't actually know if the radio had a video feed. Bender's comment about my current couture could have been an assumption based on me supposedly looking like a Quinlan. Sorry, Your Highness. Turns out your representative here speaks my home dialect.
That didn't sound like any Quinlan I'm familiar with.
Salty seas Creole, Bender interjected. Like two hounds mating is the normal description. Natasha had no answer, but I noticed that her face quirked in a suppressed smile. I decided I'd have to listen to some salty seas Creole at some point. Bender hurried to press his advantage. It turns out that Bob is from a salty seas clan that got scattered. And we've been trying to find more of us to group up with, I added, hoping I hadn't just shot Bender in the foot.
How does this change anything?
You know the legends about the Salty Seas people, Bender replied. Even allowing for a lot of exaggeration, they were fierce warriors and tough athletes. Now assume some exaggeration on the part of our agents, partly to excuse their own incompetence, and suddenly you have Quinlans who can fly.
How did he throw Popeye across the room?
We have a form of fighting where we use the opponent's weight and momentum against him, I volunteered. Popeye was coming at me. I just redirected him toward the wall. It was not quite a lie, and a pretty plausible description of jiu-jitsu, especially for someone who hadn't been there.
So he doesn't know anything, and we've revealed ourselves to him?
You haven't revealed anything that isn't already part of rumor or legend in the general populace, I said. You aren't nearly as secret as you think. Neither is the administrator. Wow, I was really racking up the lies. I hoped my karma meter wouldn't throw a sprocket. Natasha came over, grabbed a chair, and sat across from me. Philip scritched his chair over to give her some space.
So, what shall we do with you, Bob?
She asked.
The safest thing would be to dispose of you.
I nodded. Yep. Assuming you can without me causing a lot of damage on the way out, and assuming my friends don't get wind of it and come after you, and, I held up a finger in a dramatic gesture, assuming you really aren't any better than the administrator and their minions. I mean, this whole thing about fighting for the people and so forth, well, it could be just so much fertilizer. Natasha gave me a thin smile.
A very transparent attempt at manipulation, Bob.
She turned to the radio.
What do you think, Motorola?
He's not our enemy. At worst, he's neutral.
He knows who we are, though.
I know who you are, personally, I interjected. What am I going to do with that? Run to the administrator, assuming I can even find them?
Nevertheless.
Natasha became thoughtful for a moment, then grimaced in apparent distaste and turned to Philip.
Kill him. Make it quick.
Philip didn't hesitate. I think maybe I'd hurt his feelings earlier. He grabbed one of his larger implements of destruction and stabbed straight at where my heart should be. Computer reflexes or not, breaking the manacles slowed me down. I didn't want more damage to my wrists, so I had to avoid yanking on the chains with my full strength. Unfortunately, that meant I wasn't quite able to get out of the way of the knife. I twisted and watched in slow motion as the blade slashed across my chest, opening a long, shallow cut in my skin. Fake blood spurted, then slowed as internal systems went into high alert. I grabbed Philip by the wrist and shoulder and helped him continue his journey in a straight line, ending against the wall. He bounced with a most satisfying thump and fell to the ground. Quickly, I kicked my feet, breaking the last links holding me. Natasha pulled one of the tranquilizer guns and took aim. I spared a moment to wonder if she was a double agent, but no. More likely, they'd liberated the gun from one of the administrator's minions at some point. All very interesting, but she was about to shoot me, which could be bad in so many ways. At minimum, when I didn't drop to the ground and drool on the carpet, my cover would be blown. At worst, the dart might hit a critical system. I wasn't invulnerable by any means. Everything slowed in my perception as I frame-jacked as much as possible without losing the connection with my Manny. I watched the barrel of the gun and tried to calculate the trajectory as I moved to the side at maximum speed. Natasha's expression turned to surprise and panic.